Celebrate with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to the 101st episode of Robots. I am Jana, and in this episode, we'll continue the celebrations of Robots Podcast's episodes reaching triple digits with some of the big names in robotics. First up, we will hear from George Becky, one of the fathers of robotics. And then, we'll have a short contribution from Rodney Brooks, one of the founders of iRobot. But first, as always, here are the latest news and developments in robotics with Christine.
Thank you. A Spanish aerospace engineering student has created a robot that can copy graphics from her computer to your whiteboard. The Garabatobot, or Doodlebot in English, connects to your laptop via USB. It uses two strings to attach to the corners of a whiteboard and two stepper motors to vary the string lengths to move around the whiteboard, drawing precise shapes and patterns. The robot is simple, consisting of nothing more than a few 3D printed parts, the two motors, an Arduino board with Bluetooth module and batteries, making it an ideal do-it-yourself project that will have your office mates wondering about your miraculously acquired drawing talent. In other news, U.S. company Boston Dynamics has released new videos of their Sandflea and Rex robots. The Sandflea is a small, four-wheeled jumping robot based on the Boston Dynamics Precision Urban Hopper robot, which you may dimly remember from our coverage in 2009. In this new video, the robot is seen jumping onto the roof of the buildings and back down again. It can clear obstacles of up to 10 meters or 30 feet in height and is precise enough to jump into a second-floor window. The new Rex video shows what appears to be a ruggedized version of the six-legged all-terrain robot. As in previous videos, the Rex is shown successfully navigating through rough terrain, such as a forest creek with large rocks. For more on the Doodlebot, Boston Dynamics videos, and other news, have a look at www.robotspodcast.com.
George Becky started building robots in the 1960s. He was the founder of the Biomedical Engineering Department and the Robotics Research Laboratory at the University of Southern California in the 1980s. In 2005, he published a new book entitled Autonomous Robots, and currently he serves on the advisory boards of several robotics and high-tech companies. He spoke to our reporter Sabine about the history of robotics and his vision of the future, with an emphasis on bio-inspiration, learning, human-robot interactions, and ethics.
Hi, George. Welcome to Robots.
Thank you, Sabine. Happy to be here.
Can you maybe start by introducing yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is George Becky. I was on the faculty at the University of Southern California at USC for 40 years before I retired 10 years ago. But I continue to be active both in a consulting capacity and by giving lectures and writing. I started robotics first in the 1960s, and then after a 20-year interval, finally started the robotics laboratory at USC in the 1980s.
1960s, wow. What made you start a lab in robotics in the 1980s?
Well, let me back up to the 60s, just for one second, because we built the first walking machine built in the United States, to the best of my knowledge, in the 1960s. And this was a four-legged walking machine that we called the Phony Pony. You can see a picture of it in my book, Autonomous Robots, in the chapter that deals with the four-legged machines. And I think for its time, it was actually quite remarkable. And it did, in fact, walk in a variety of gaits, on the patio in front of the engineering building. But because we had no microprocessors in those days, it was connected to a mainframe computer by a long cable. And so that was really our first experiment. And then I went on to other things until the 1980s.
Did you feel at that time like there was a need to open a lab in robotics? Was this something that was common? Were people starting to open robotics labs?
Well, not exactly. I had been working in three different areas. One was ways of describing mathematically the way humans relate to machines. For example, to try to describe the way in which you might be able to predict a pilot's movements of the stick from what he sees as a visual input on the screen in front of him. And I was also interested in control in various ways. So when in the early 1980s, we recruited a young fellow from Stanford who stayed at USC only a few years. He was interested in the use of robots for manufacturing. That's all we had in the 1980s. These were robot manipulators, electromechanical arms. They were used for such things as assembling automobiles. And he said, you know, I came to USC. I didn't know whether you guys did any work in robotics, but I really need a robot to do my work. Can you find me one? And what he meant by robot was one of these arms, you see. So I wrote a proposal to the National Science Foundation, got money, and bought a Unimation Puma robot. Puma stood for Programmable Universal Manipulator Arm. And that was the first robot we had at USC.
That's excellent. How did research evolve since those days where you were looking at mechanical arms to today?
Well, we first worked on arms, and also I was very interested in trying to build hands for robots that contained, that had five fingers and were able to adapt to the shapes of the objects they would grasp. So I worked on hands for a number of years until the early 1990s. And in the interim, in my lab, some of my students began to get interested in machines that could also move and walk in some way. So the evolution occurred gradually from manipulators to robot hands to walking machines.
And maybe you can describe one of the projects that you're the most proud of that came out of USC.
Well, we built a number of walking machines, and they included a six-legged robot. This was basically a powered insect, something analogous to the machines that that Rodney Brooks students built at MIT. And for that reason, we called our machine Rodney. I'm not sure he was very pleased with that, but that's what we called it. And then we also built a six-legged machine, which learned how to walk. Actually, the interesting thing about this particular machine was that we did not program the leg movements. Instead, we used the genetic algorithm. This is a computer program based more or less on an approach to evolution, synthetic evolution of some kind. And what this machine then did, based on this algorithm, it learned how to place which leg after which leg so that it could learn how to walk. So what happened was, initially, since the legs were not programmed, it would just lie on the ground and the legs would flail randomly. But what we did is we kept finding the best example of the machine being able to move forward. And we used that as initial conditions for another generation of machines. And the next ones did a little bit better, and the next ones did a little bit better. So that after some 40 generations or so, the machine was able to walk. And it was interesting because the gaits that it developed were in fact similar to insect gaits, but what's interesting about this, you see, is that it developed them on its own. We did not have a program which said, now pick up left front, then pick up medium, right rear, and so on. That it learned how to do by itself. And I think that was a wonderful project.
So what do you think was the main motivation for this? Was it to understand biology? Was it to advance AI and the whole learning aspect? Was it to make a creature that could walk with all the mechanics? I mean, was there a specific aim, or was it just the beauty of discovering these machines?
You know, that's a somewhat difficult to answer, because I didn't have a very clear motivation in mind when I worked with my students on building these machines. In some sense, the next project always evolved somehow accidentally. It was they resulted from conversations with ideas that the students had, and then I would add my ideas, and eventually we began to build something, and it wasn't quite right, so we built something else. So I think to a large extent, the development of the six or so different kinds of walking machines that we built in the lab was almost fortuitous. You know, they arose and they each got better, but that wasn't because of a very systematic plan on my part.
Speaking of bioinspiration, your book Autonomous Robots that you mentioned before is really one of the first books that I read in robotics, really when I just started my PhD. And it stuck with me, so I really used bioinspiration as a drive in the work that I've been doing. And I'm wondering what your take is on bioinspiration now. I mean, as processing power and algorithms are improving, do you think that bioinspiration or more reactive approaches is still the right way to go when you design autonomous robots?
Well, I would say the answer to that is yes and no. But by the way, thank you for reading the book. I'm glad to actually find someone who's read it.
Oh, well, it was on our lab shelf. I've actually, a lot of people read it.
Well, very good. No, I think that's wonderful. My initial view of autonomous machines was very much modeled on biology, and I was very interested in the way in which muscles work and neuromuscular systems in general, so that we could try to apply those ideas to robotics. The six-legged machine that evolved its manner of walking was very much based on biology, and we learned a lot about insects and doing it and so on. I think now, at the present time, I would say that we're driven by a combination of trying to emulate living systems and developments in technology. In other words, I think many things have been possible because of Moore's Law, which might not have been possible, you know, even 20 years ago. As processors became smaller, lighter, and more efficient and faster, this meant that we could build different kinds of machines which were just absolutely impossible in the 1980s or 90s. And as you probably know, there are a number of military programs now, and some civilian ones as well, that build the flying machines the size of a sparrow, or little machines that look like insects. And that's because we can now put in absolutely miniaturized processors and batteries. So I think these technological developments have made possible the development of new robots, which were absolutely unthinkable in the 1990s.
Is it, to a certain extent, more advanced bio-inspired robots as well? Would you consider, for example, the sparrow being a bio-inspired robot, just more,
yes,
more technically advanced?
Well, yes, because in addition to batteries and processors, a lot of work has been done in sensors. And I always view a robot as a machine that senses, thinks, and acts. So that what it has to do, it needs sensors to pick up information from the world. It needs these processors that we just talked about, the very fast, miniaturized computers. And then it needs actuators. And in order to move. And so within the last 10 or 20 years, there have been enormous advances in sensors and in actuators as well. So I think these things have made the development of smarter and more able robots possible.
You mentioned muscles before. You also have a huge expertise in biomedical engineering, and I'm wondering how it impacted the way you did robotics, but also the opposite way, how it impacted the way you did biomedical engineering.
Well, that's a very good question, because I think these things always go in both directions when you try to work between two disciplines. So I was intrigued at trying to find materials that would shorten when stimulated, and in order to be able to emulate the way that a muscle behaves. And there are a number of these things available. An early one was called the McKibben muscle, which was actually a helically wound tube, which when, because of the way it was wound as a helix, when it was filled with compressed air, it would shorten, like a muscle does. And so therefore it was possible to generate motion with it, which emulated the way that muscles work. When I was consulting at a hospital in Downey, California, we actually tried to build some prosthetic devices using these artificial muscles. Unfortunately, it meant mounting a tank of compressed air on a wheelchair, and this was awkward. You had to keep recharging it and so on. So it was not practical, but it was an interesting experiment along the way. Then there are materials which, when electrically stimulated, will shorten. And some of these have been used very successfully in underwater robots. The advantage here being that they require cooling, because when they shorten, they heat up. And so you need to cool them in some way. And if a machine walks underwater, then the cooling is automatic. And so a number of such devices have been built as well. So I think that's an example in which I think trying to build something in the way in which a human muscle works has provided us with a means of locomotion for robots. But obviously that's not the only way. And most robots operate in the way that you would expect the machine to work, you know, namely gears and levers and so on, in order to operate the limbs of a machine.
And looking more broadly now, I want to take a step back and look at all of robotics from your point of view, who has seen a bit the evolution of this field. How do you think robotics has evolved as a whole in, let's say, the last 50 years?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think up through the 1980s, we associated the word robot primarily to describe a powered manipulator. And so these machines were used primarily in industry. And I think you're familiar with the background of this. These General Motors installed a large number of them in some of their factories in combination with a Japanese company. Then beginning in the 1990s, as we began to move into machines that could move, mobile robots of various kinds, I think the view of the future of robotics began to change. Actually, there was a robotics recession at the end of early 1990s, so that many of the companies that made manipulators in the United States went out of business or were bought by other companies abroad. In those early years, General Electric made manipulators, so did IBM. IBM built a very interesting machine that actually moved along XY coordinates rather than along circular coordinates. And all these companies either went out of business or sold. Unimation, which was the original company building manipulators in the United States, which was founded by Duvall and Engelberger, was eventually sold to a German company. So this meant that there was a kind of a regrouping of the whole field. And the progress only continued in university laboratories because industry support basically died. So then in the 1900s, as we began to move toward larger numbers of mobile robots of various kinds, walking machines, humanoids, various kinds of simulated two-legged machines, where we now had to struggle with the issues of equilibrium and stability and so on. So that began the evolution toward contemporary robots. Then in the 21st century, flying machines of various kinds, which displayed the same kind of autonomy, began to be developed. So I think what we've seen, also within the last 10 years, we've seen more and more interaction between humans and robots. That I consider to be one of the fundamental changes of what's happened in the field. Because up through the 1980s and even into the early 90s, when robots were primarily manipulators, it was very important to keep humans and robot arms apart because they were dangerous. And at least one person was killed in Japan and one in the United States by a robot arm. Now, however, the trend in human-robot interaction, the field is sometimes abbreviated HRI, human-robot interaction, now the tendency is to find ways in which humans and robots can collaborate and interact in a variety of tasks and situations. So I think the evolution has been from robot arms to mobile robots of various kinds to robots that can interact with humans and to do so in a larger and larger number of situations and tasks. And I think that's continuing. I think what we're seeing now is the appearance of robots in more and more aspects of our lives, you know, from robots that can clean city streets or change light bulbs on light poles to robots that work with disabled children, elderly people, even children with autism spectrum disorders. So I think that the field is continually evolving.
This is a tricky question, but do you feel there's a best and worst development?
That's a very good question. I don't know about the best, but I can tell you about some of the worst.
Sure.
Let's see. So I think, in the early days of robot manipulators, there was at least one company that tried to build a robot that was actuated by compressed air. It was a pneumatic robot rather than being either electric or hydraulic. Most manipulators are electrical. They're just driven by electric motors. Some they use that require a great deal of power in order to lift heavy weights are hydraulic. And one company tried to make them by using compressed air on the theory that this would be less expensive and faster and so on. And the trouble is there were two problems that they didn't reckon with. One is that air is compressible. So what happens is you try to exert a force and the air would compress and then it would release. And so what happened was these things had a tendency to oscillate. They would go back and forth and back and forth and air would leak. I had a friend at that time who saw one of these machines in action, and he said from all the leaking air that he heard, that he said it sounded like an elephant passing gas. Not very polite, but that's what he said. So that was one of the things that I think was a mistake. Another one, which was very important in its day, but I think was wrong, was the development of a hand, a multi-fingered hand, called the Utah MIT robot hand. It was probably developed by Steve Jacobson at the University of Utah. And 10 of these hands were built. Each one of them cost roughly $100,000 under sponsorship of the National Science Foundation. Now, the hands were actually remarkable in their capability and versatility. But I think the principle was entirely wrong because visualize a finger being made up of three segments. So the way these machines were built is that they had three cables They had six cables for each finger, three that moved the segments in one direction and three that moved it in the other direction. Because when you're pulling on a cable, you can't also push. See, a cable can only be used for pulling. So in order to be able to rotate a finger in a closed direction and open direction, you needed two sets of cables. So there was a multitude of cables from this hand to a remote series of motors, and it was a control nightmare. They worked, and they were mechanically extremely able. I recall that one of these hands was able to use an index finger to tap, and it could tap as faster than a human, of the order of 10 taps per second. I mean, very fast. So from that point of view, they were remarkable. But I think from a control point of view and a manufacturing point of view, they were just a mistake, and they rapidly disappeared.
You mentioned before that robotics is becoming more ubiquitous. We're having more and more robots in our lives. We're interacting more with them. And I feel personally like we're at a tipping point in robotics. In my mailbox, I get IEEE career alerts, and just a couple weeks ago they were saying that the hiring demand for robotics is up 44% this year, and there's a ton of robotic startups that are flourishing, that are being sold. Do you think robotics is finally becoming mainstream? And if so, what is driving this?
Well, I mean, I think you hinted at all the right things. You know, I remember in the 1990s when Rod Brooks and I would appear on the same program, both of us would say, well, in the next 10 years will be the beginning of the age of robotics, and they'll be ubiquitous, and everybody will have robots and appear in all aspects. Well, it didn't happen in the 1990s, and it didn't happen in the 2000s, but it's definitely happening now. So I think our forecasts were probably at least 10 years ahead of their time. But now, I think you're right, it's absolutely happening. Now, there's another factor. Until relatively recently, venture capitalists whom I knew were very reluctant to invest in robotics, because in the 1990s, various startups went down the drain and venture capitalists lost money. So for a long time, there was a fear of robots among the venture capital companies. And I think in the United States, where we have relatively little direct government assistance for the kinds of things, for industry, you know, we do provide government assistance to university laboratories, but not for industry. So whereas other countries do, but we don't. So for us, we really depend on the availability of private capital to start these companies. And within the last 5 years, we're beginning to see a major kind of a burst in the availability of venture capital. And that's, I think, one of the things that's driving the surge in startup companies.
Why are they funding robotics now? What makes them believe?
Well, I think it's been gradual. You see, I mean, now you can begin to see that these machines, first of all, don't fail all the time. They're now becoming reliable. You know, you can build a machine that'll work the way in which computers now almost never fail. You know, I mean, I remember in the early days, you know, because I'm old enough to have seen this, in the early days of digital computers, we used to talk about mean time between failures of 10 minutes. And so, you know, you turn on the computer, you figure within the next 10 minutes it's going to fail. And now you turn on your PC, and you don't expect it to fail, do you? So I think the issue of reliability has been one of the major ones. Secondly, I think we've seen enough examples now of machines coming out of university laboratories and small startups to make people think that maybe something is really going on. The third factor is international competition. In 2004, about 8 years ago or so, I led a study group funded by NSF, the National Science Foundation, to look at the status of robotics in Japan and Central Europe. And what we found was, in general, that many of the Japanese robotics companies and Korean companies, as well as European companies, were actually ahead of us. And I think that message is also getting across, that the United States must catch up. And if we don't do it soon, it's going to be much too late. I think out of the 25 or 40 laboratories, I think 25 in Japan and Korea and another 20 or so in Europe, I would venture that 90% of them are working on robotics for elder care. And nobody was doing it in the United States, you see. So I think that that was part of what drove last year's development of the National Robotics Initiative by the federal government. President Obama announced it last year, and then a group of agencies, National Science Foundation, NASA, and others, began to set aside money to support work in robotics. So my sense is that those factors, international competition, the awareness of the fact that the government was now taking robotics seriously, particularly in the private sector, were things that spurred venture capitalists to begin to take another look and begin to invest.
You're actually on the advisory board of several robotics companies. Can you maybe give us some insight on the challenges and opportunities that are faced by robotics companies now?
Okay, that's a tricky question, and I don't know quite how to answer it because I still think that the majority of startups are going to fail. Robots are tricky creatures until you have the experience. So I think the most successful ones are the ones that grow out of prototypes built in university laboratories, where some of the same people who built them at the university then go and start a company. But it's difficult to do that and at the same time make sure that they become saleable products. You know, a machine built in a university laboratory may be unnecessarily complex for a commercial application. So there's a lot of engineering that needs to be done on machines that meet the challenges of becoming commercial products. So I think that in the next decade or so, we're going to see a number of successful robotics companies with a large variety of applications, and we'll also see the carcasses of fallen robotics companies by the wayside.
It's the same in every field, I guess.
I think so.
So if you were to start a lab now, let's say to make the next generation product, what would your lab be working on?
Gee, that's a good question. Obviously, in the area of human-robot relations, I mean, I would like to continue to work in areas in which humans and robots can collaborate in a variety of ways. But that also means that they have to be able to communicate with one another. You know, it's the robot has to be able to send messages back to the human. It's not enough for the human to give commands to the robot. The robot has to respond as well. And whether it does so by voice or whether it does it by gestures. And these are all things we have to experiment with and find the best way of doing. As you know, one of the great computer robot developments within the last several years has been Microsoft's Kinect, which is a way of using gestures to control computer games. But, of course, roboticists have seized on this immediately to realize that you can use gestures to control machines. But the machine also has to gesture, and you and I have to be able to recognize the machine's gestures as well. Robots should be able to read our facial expressions. But that also means that I would like my robots to have the ability to generate facial expressions that I can understand. You know, it should be able to frown and smile and so on. So it's in the area of human-robot interaction. And in addition to that, there are a couple of other areas related to that, which I'd like to see work on in the lab. I would like robots to be able to appreciate aesthetic aspects of their experience and our joint experience with them. What I mean by that is, if I'm going to develop a robot that designs equipment or machines, I would like it to prefer to build things which are attractive rather than ugly. Now,
it's very subjective.
Part. Very subjective, exactly. But there are criteria, you know. We would like it, for example, if it builds an automobile, it should have smooth, curved lines and not be made of jagged angles. Isn't that right? I mean, I wouldn't want to buy an automobile that looked like a Model T, you know, with very sharp angles.
Tying back to the learning that we started with, do you see this as being an incremental process with the human and the robot sort of discovering each other's tastes and enforcing certain things that look good and maybe discouraging the jagged angles on the car?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you're right on. I think it's a learning and developmental kind of a process, and I think these things will happen gradually. Now, and the third aspect of this laboratory will be in what is now my current interest, which is in the ethical uses of robots. And I think one of the major challenges for society in the next decade will be to develop laws and a legal structure for handling interactions between robots and humans. We don't have any, you know. I mean, there is no way now of citing a legal precedent for what happens if a robot injures a human. Partly this is related to the fact that much of the money for robotics has come from military robots, many of which are designed to kill humans. Right? I mean, they kill the enemy, they don't kill our own people, except by accident. But I think these are all issues that we haven't figured out how to handle. And I think that the ethical uses of robots in relation to children, in relation to the elderly, remember that robots are being used in surgery increasingly and in other medical applications. There are ethical and unethical ways of using them. And I don't think that we have any idea yet for the development of a legal system for judging how these things are done. Let me give you an example. I mean, this may be very simple, but in the relation between a child and a robot, should there be restrictions on the way those two relate to one another? You know, I mean, clearly a child can take a robot and break it. Well, all right. But now what happens if the robot is trying to do repairs on a bridge? Is it okay to break it? And if so, who's responsible? Let me pose a different question. You have a robot that does surgery on a human being in a hospital, and the surgery goes badly. So whom does the patient, presuming he survives, whom does he sue? He doesn't sue the robot, right? So he would have to sue whom? The manufacturer, the designer, the people who provide the materials, the programmer? I think we have absolutely no precedent for doing these things. And this area interests me a great deal. I have two friends at the California Polytechnic University in San Luis Obispo, which is where I currently live, who are in the philosophy department, and they're both, their specialty is ethics. They're ethicists. And the three of us have just edited a book published by MIT Press, of all places, called Robot Ethics. It came out in January.
We just saw recently in Nevada, they passed a law to be able to allow autonomous cars on their streets. And I think the U.S. just recently passed a law for allowing drones to fly to a certain extent above the field. So these are little steps, but like what framework do you need to actually do something substantial? Or is it just going to happen when these liability cases come up or when people start to realize that they don't want robots behaving in this way?
Well, you see, you may be right. In Los Angeles, there used to be a common saying that the city will never put a stop sign on a corner until the second child is killed. The first one is considered an accident, the second one begins to realize a problem. So I think when the first one of these unmanned aircraft crashes and causes major death and calamity, suddenly we're going to realize that we don't have any legal framework for what to do. So, I think that each of these areas, whether it's in robots as caregivers, robots as sex partners, which is increasingly happening, robots as transportation systems, and so on. Each of these areas, I think, is going to require new and different approaches to the way we handle issues of liability and risk.
One final question to wrap up. How do you see the future of robotics? And try to aim far down the road, maybe the next 50 years.
Well, the last person who asked me this question, what I told them was, well, the thing I can tell you for sure is that there will be robots in your future. Because I think increasingly we're finding that they're everywhere. I think robots will in fact be ever present. We'll have robots not only in the factory, but on the street and in the home. And in the school. And so I think it's this pervasiveness of intelligent machines which I think is going to characterize the future. And I think it's an exciting time. I think we'll find that there are many routine tasks that we've done that we'll be able to relegate to robots. And there will be other places where I think it's going to be essential to maintain human control over what these situations are. I don't know if you remember that Norbert Wiener, another MIT person, wrote this book called The Human Use of Human Beings. And I think that that's increasingly going to be one of the things that we'll be looking at. I think we want to make sure that in these future social situations in which robots will be ever-present, that we maintain our knowledge and awareness of where human control begins and ends and where robot activity begins and ends. So I think we look at robots partly because we learn something about ourselves from looking at these machines and where our limits are. But I think at the same time, we need to exert careful control over what these machines are going to do and where they will be present. So I think it's an exciting time ahead. In many ways, I'm very, you know, I've lived through a fascinating time in seeing all this develop, and now the young people just coming out of college are going to have an incredibly interesting scientific, technical world in front of them.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much, George, for joining us on Robots.
You're welcome.
Rodney Brooks has been one of the main actors in the field of robotics for the past 30 years. Apart from being one of the founders of iRobot, he was the director of the MIT Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, CSAIL, until 2007. Currently, he's the founder, chairman, and CTO of Heartland Robotics, a company that aims to revolutionize manufacturing and increase productivity of industries using robots that are teachable, safe, and affordable. Our reporter Per was able to briefly meet him at the Robot Dalen conference in Sweden.
I know that programming teaching robots how to do what we want them to do is something you care about. How do you see us best doing that?
Well, we really want our robots to be able to understand the world. Mm-hmm. So we need to give them better perceptual systems so that they can understand what is in the world around them. I think having dumb robots that don't really understand the world leads to very disappointing interactions with the robots, and is why industrial robots of today, I think, don't exist in small and medium enterprises, because they don't know much, so you have to build a special environment for them. They're too dangerous to be with, so they can only make sense in very large companies. And I think that small companies have missed out on the benefits that we can have from robots, because we haven't made them smart enough to be easy to install so that they can do useful work for smaller enterprises.
So are you working, or are you looking into the how reprogramming teaching by doing, so we show them what they're supposed to do and they learn from that? Is that something you think that we're going to do more of?
Yeah, well, I like to use the analogy. Imagine you had an iPhone, but in order to use it on a daily basis, you needed to program it in COBOL. It would be a pretty, it wouldn't have sold anywhere near as many, right? And mainframes used to have to program in COBOL. But the transition between a mainframe and an iPhone was that it was became easier and easier to use. And even a computer scientist doesn't want to program their iPhone. They just want to use it. Mm-hmm. They could program it if they had to, but... And our industrial robots all have to be programmed right now, and they have to be programmed with, you know, quaternions and six dimensional vectors and stuff. So that's
kinematics, that's
not the level that, to be a useful universal tool that we need to have the interfaces. So they have to be smarter to have a different sort of interface. Now whether it's teach by showing or not, I think is a that's one solution. I think there might be other solutions that we haven't thought of yet.
Mm-hmm. But that's the one we're focusing on now. And you can't say anything about any of the other ones that you also think competes for being the one there, compared alongside teach by doing.
Yeah, you could. But teach by doing, you could also say another one might be to go direct from CAD and have the system just look at the CAD models of what needs to be done and figure it all out. Because, you know, for any product, there is a CAD model. So there's already the data there in that sense. So I think there are different ways and there's different aspects of it. But another is just more general sensing of the world. So the robot is more aware of what's going on in the world. That might make it a whole lot easier to interact with. If it knows that it shouldn't collide with things and it can sense things, then you don't have to program that into it.
Those two together makes it obvious. Huh?
Yeah. So low-level capabilities. It gets back to, you know, and this is my, you know, has been my philosophy for a long time of building layered systems. You put the low-level stuff that takes care of the dumb stuff, and then it's easier to put the higher-level stuff on because you don't have to worry about the edge cases anymore because the lower levels just take care of things for you.
Yeah, and that also analogizes to how we as humans are built up. I mean, we have the unconscious that takes care of a lot of things, and then we have the conscious us that takes care of other things.
Yeah, exactly.
And they would be equally inappropriate to take care of each other's tasks. You've also worked on the border between matter and machines and the living.
Well, I've thought about it.
Yeah, you've thought about it. And you also worked with Kismet, which is a very expressive robot. It uses ears.
In fairness, Kismet was developed by my PhD student.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't let me program it much at all.
Did you have a chance to play with it?
Of course.
It looks very nice to work with. Huh?
Yeah, yes, yes. Actually, there's an interesting story about that. Both Kismet and Cog were contemporary robots. And it was interesting because the students who'd programmed them, there were multiple students working on them, sometime in the lab, you know, where the students had their desks, they'd put up a curtain between them and the robot. Because when they were working there and the robot was doing its social interaction, it would, wake up or get rebooted and look around and look at people. And they felt, oh, you know, it was like there was a social being there and it caught their eye. Even though they may be the one who programmed that in there, it was like having another person, you know, nearby staring at them and all the time. It makes it very uncomfortable to work on something else. So it was interesting that those social cues impacted the people who had done the programming.
Even though they know, it's
forced on you. We as humans are so attuned to those social cues, we always respond to them. We find it very hard to, ignore them. You know, if you're on a subway and there's some crazy person on the subway who comes up to you and tries to make eye contact with you, you look away, you don't want to engage. But it's really hard to ignore a person who's close to you doing some sort of social interaction.
Yeah, and this is also borders then on the uncanny valley issue. And what I was thinking is, how do we construct a robot like Kismet that interacts in a human-like way, but clearly enough that it says it's robotic clearly enough that we can understand it, but we don't trigger this, oh, there's something funny going on here mechanism?
Well, I think something funny is okay. I think that's slightly different from the to me, Uncanny Valley. I think it has to be. We have to make the robots authentic in what they promise. So if they're promising something, they better deliver. So I've seen some robots which have a robot body and then have a very human-like, human realistic head on them, and that's sort of promising something that the robot isn't going to deliver. There's one with a very famous scientist head, and it sort of promises that it's going to be super intelligent, but it's not. So I think that people get very disappointed then, and very upset if it's an inauthentic promise. So even at the social level, if the robot looks over at something, it really should be looking and about to do something about that object that it's looking at. It not just should be randomly moving its eyes around as though it's paying attention to other things.
So there should be a link between what it gets capable of and how it looks.
Yeah.
If those two match, we're okay with it. If they're not.
Yeah. If they're not, yeah. So it's authentic delivery on the promise.
The upcoming robot revolution that we at the podcast and you foresee and think, could you just give us?
I don't think it's upcoming. I think we're in the middle of it. Yeah, it's often very hard to tell. So I think that we now have millions of home cleaning robots out there. That's a change in our world. A statistic I heard recently is that 20%. Of all new vacuum cleaners being bought in Spain are robotic vacuum cleaners. That's an astonishingly large number. So we are starting to have our robots in our everyday lives. It's no longer so weird. We see here in Sweden at the Robot Dalen, they're working on robots to go into hospitals and into people's homes. And that's not viewed as, oh, that's strange. That's bizarre. Now I think people are sort of, yeah, there are robots around. And
they're slightly even exciting rather than scary. Huh?
Yeah. We expect that now. So I think we are seeing it happen. It's definitely happened in the military.
Mm-hmm. They're totally fine with them.
Yes. And and at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this year, there were lots and lots of little robot companies. I don't think all of them will survive, but lots and lots of little robot companies showing new robotic devices of various sorts. So I think we see it happening, and in the U.S. at least, it's now become a category that venture capitalists talk about. What are you doing in the robot space?
You have to have some kind of a knowledge about it, otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're there. There's a momentum that's happening that's undeniable, and people who are in academia in robotics can see, yes, what I'm doing might get out into a product, whereas I don't think that was the case 20 years ago. I think it was too esoteric at that point. But I think now any PhD student can have in their mind, yeah, I can work on something that can actually turn into a real product for within my within my early career, yes.
You started these successful robot companies, and we saw here today that you went through all these different ideas. What would be your main tip for some of these students that listen to the podcast? They want to start a company. What would be your...
This is sort of business 101 almost. Even if you're going to be revolutionary with your technology, you have to find something that people will value. If they don't value... If what you're giving them doesn't provide any value to them, they're not going to pay money for it. So you have to think about the customers, maybe ask potential people. Don't get them to invent your product, but what is it that what will make their lives better? What will
listen
make their
to
lives...
them, but don't listen to them too carefully.
Yes, exactly.
And the iteration process where you went through all these different business ideas?
Oh, yes, we spent years and years flailing about. I don't recommend approaching it the way we did. We started with a technology, and we're looking for an application. I think you really have to hone in on the application much quicker than we did.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
And that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and as always, you can find all the background information and all of our past episodes on our website at robotspodcast.com. And if you have any feedback for us, just get in touch via info@robotspodcast.com. The next episode will be coming up in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Celebrate with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.